Welcome to the weekly broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Club. The Commonwealth Club is a nonpartisan public forum dedicated to airing diverse views on important topics of national interest. Today's program was made possible by the members of the Commonwealth Club and Bank of the West.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at thecommonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and, of course, on our YouTube channel. I'm Mike Bracco, Chief Administrative Officer at Bank of the West and also a member of the Board of Governors for the Commonwealth Club. Bank of the West, like the Commonwealth Club, is headquartered in San Francisco Bay Area with roots dating back over 100 years. And we're really proud to support the Commonwealth Club in bringing important thought leaders and public issues, such as tonight's presentation, to the community. Tonight's guest, we have John Hope Bryant. John is chairman and CEO of Operation Hope. He was raised in South Central Los Angeles, where he saw firsthand how poverty was a barrier to the dreams and opportunity. John believed if he could educate himself, he could not only prosper, but also contribute his leadership to ending poverty. Immediately following the Rodney King riots of 1992, John founded Operation Hope. It's a nonprofit organization with a mission to expand opportunity in underserved communities throughout economic and education. Today, over 20 years later, Operation Hope operates in communities across the United States and in countries around the world. John has served as the chairman of the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability, Subcommittee on the Underserved and Community Empowerment, and he was appointed by President Obama in 2014 as a member of the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability for Young Americans. John is here today to discuss his work and his new book, How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. Your moderator this evening is Van Jones, an American environmentalist and civil rights advocate and host of CNN's Crossfire. He is also co-founder of several impactful nonprofits, including Rebuilding the Dream, a national advocacy organization working towards a fairer economy. Please join me in a warm welcome for John Hope Bryant and Van Jones.
Well, first of all, glad to be here, glad to see you. Let's just get down to it. You have a great deal of courage, not just because you grew up in Compton, but because you came to San Francisco, a city that has probably benefited more from capitalism than any other city, but is probably more critical of capitalism than any other city, talking about how capitalism can help poor people. Now, that takes courage to come to this liberal, left-leaning town and even begin a conversation with that. So before the audience takes you apart, I want to give you the opportunity to explain yourself, brother. How is it that capitalism can be good for poor people?
Well, hello to you too, Van. I was going to introduce you as my friend, but you can have it now. I'm going to order a car service for you just so I can cancel it. Okay, so let me first say that capitalism does not need me to defend it, and I'm not going to defend it. I will agree, actually, with my friends, some of my friends in San Francisco who would say that capitalism is a horrible system. It is a horrible system, except for every other system. Like democracy, it's very messy. But let's take democracy for a minute. Only in America can you go to the White House gates, curse your president out, see him coming out in the car, wave your finger at him, lecture him. And then your girlfriend sees you tomorrow at work and says, "Girl, I saw you cursing out the President of the United States of America on channel whatever news. You bold. Let's go. What are we going to get for lunch?" Now, try that in China. You will disappear. Try that in Russia. Try that almost any place in the world. And you will not be at work tomorrow. This is an amazing place where you actually grow through constructive friction. Only through constructive friction do you grow. You cannot have a rainbow without a storm first. So even communist countries like China and Russia, and I was in China last week, have selected capitalism as their vehicle for change and prosperity. It is a highly imperfect system. But in my analysis of all systems in the world, and I've been to 100 countries, like you, I travel a lot, and I've not seen anything that has the transformational power and potential that it has. But I have a deeper reason of why I'm backing it. Number one is the only reason I named this book How the Poor Can Save Capitalism is that nobody would have taken me seriously if I had named it How the Poor Are Already Saving Capitalism. And I will show, if you ask me, if we get to it, I will, because we're trying to deal with, I know, some, a lot of meaty issues tonight, I will go into to some very specific detail, data-driven, of how the poor are already saving capitalism and getting no credit for it. And then I have another reason that actually gives me enormous hope of why I think that this might be powerful for poor people, but I'll, again, wait to unpack that. I hope that I answered that question adequately.
Your particular insight in this book that got my attention, that we talked about a little bit before, is this idea of 700 credit score communities. And, you know, I'm a good liberal Democrat, so when I think about fighting poverty, I don't think about a 700 credit score community. I might think about a bill to pass. I might think about some corporations to tax. I might think about a program to start. You don't start with that. You don't start with tax the rich. You don't start with a program. You start with 700 credit score community. Why is that your entry point, or one of your many entry points, into moving the needle and helping us, quote unquote, get the memo?
This concept that we hate rich people, It's a lie. We hate rich people until we become rich. It's a lie. What we hate is a game system. What we hate is a system rigged against fair play, against our ability to compete on a level playing field, where we don't understand the rules, where the playing field's not level.
We don't hate winners, we hate cheaters.
Correct. So it is a lie that we hate rich people, and we need to stop saying that. 700 credit scores. Nothing changes your life more than God or love than moving your credit score 120 points. Number one cause for divorce in America, money. Number one cause for domestic abuse, money. Number one reason why abused women don't leave a nutcase mate, money. Number one reason why black and brown kids drop out of college, it's not academics, it's money. I mean, I can go on. Look, let's take this into the health field. American Heart Association will tell you the number one cause for heart attacks is stress. The number one cause for stress is money. So I'm looking for, if I've got X number of years on this earth to make a difference, and if I am looking at a world that's in a 1 in 100 year paradigm shift, that I think everything is on tap to be changed right now. Everything's broken. I mean, just turn on the TV set. I mean, that's why your book, Rebuild the Dream, was, I think, so relevant for this time. And I think that in this environment, you need transformational ideas, things that if you touch it, the ripple effects can literally change generations. And oddly enough, what I tripped on was credit scores. Half of all employers require a credit check before they'll hire you. Let's talk about a neighborhood that you and I care about. An urban inner city neighborhood. You see a check casher next to a payday loan lender, next to a rent-to-own store, next to a title lender, next to a liquor store. Now, the audience will, understandably, because of the media influences, think that's a black and brown neighborhood. But there's more poor whites in America than poor anybody else. And you talk about a white, rural, small town, and you will see the same group of businesses. Go outside of a military base, and you'll find the same group of businesses. My point is that this is not racism. It's target marketing. And they're targeting a 500 credit score customer. And I'm going to rob them of their customer. Because if I've got a Bank of the West branch, and we have one in Oakland, where all this started, we now have 100 locations in 250 days. We're going to be the Starbucks of financial inclusion. And we're bringing hope inside of bank branches, hope inside of credit unions, hope inside of grocery stores, hope inside of government offices, hope inside of big box retailers. We're going to have 1,000 locations in the next 5 years within touch of every working class family in this country with too much month at the end of their money. In these locations, we're going to do mortgage counseling because I think homeownership is the hedge fund for the average working family. We're going to do homeownership and small business and entrepreneurship training. The guy who made this suit, we put in business, Drobe Clothing. I can tell the story as we get into this. We're going to do earned income tax credit because if you make $8,000 a year and you got two children and you work, the federal government owes you $4,000. That's not a credit, that's cash. It gets wired into your bank account 3 weeks after we modify your tax return. But then it's retroactive for 3 years. So if you haven't filed once, if you didn't know about it, you've never filed. That means you're not owed $4,000, you're owed, hello, $12,000. $12,000 for a family making $28,000 a year is more money they've seen at one time in any time in their working life. It's enough money to reset your mortgage, pay off your car note, send your kid to a decent college for at least 1 year. It is an opportunity to reset everything. But poor and working class families who make $50,000 a year or less qualify for EITC, but we send $10 billion back to the federal treasury every year for money that we qualify. It's our money. We don't even know to ask for it. So one out of four Americans who qualify for EITC never asked for it. So while we are picketing about this and we are marching about that, my question is, where are the civil rights marches for EITC? $10 billion a year is a whole lot of money.
That's a lot of money even in the Bay Area.
It might count for something in Silicon Valley. And so we're going to do EITC. Then we're going to do 700 credit score communities. And we have been moving credit scores 120 points over 24 months.
Wait a second. How do you do that?
So look,
I got cousins.
Yeah, we all got a cousin boo-boo. Everybody got a cousin boo-boo. Now I'm always asking for a loan. Okay, I get it. Can you hook a brother up? No, go get a job.
How you doing?
When we sit down with you, we pull your credit report. If you're black, you tend to have bad credit. If you're Latino, you tend to have no credit. It's a discrimination to say that generally, but unfortunately, it tends to stick. The immigrant population has no recorded credit. The black population was ready, fire, aim. So what they say is John Bryant had bad credit. He was homeless when he was 6 months of his life. There's no shame in having a problem, a shame in doing nothing about it. As Benjamin Mays, Dr. King's mentor, once said, that sin is not failure, it's low aim. So we unpack, we pull your credit report. We look at it. It looks like a bus accident. We all have a nice laugh. Point is, there's no shame in having problems. So let's just be easy about it. Okay, now what's the game plan to resolve this? Well, we tend to find the first success is erroneous things on your report. That ain't mine, but you haven't pulled your report in 5, 7, 10 years. So just pulling the erroneous things off your report and reporting the things that were not reported on your report gets you 30, 40, 50 points. Now your self-esteem goes up. Your chest comes out. This capitalism thing is sort of working for me. What's next, they say. And then we start looking at things that were 10 years old. I can't remember the old name of the bail company before AT&T. It was SBC or something like that. PacBail. If something shows up in your credit report that says PacBail, you know you can negotiate it. They ain't even around no more.
They can't be mad.
Anybody that's still around to sue you. So if they say that PacBail owes you, that you owe PacBail $1,000, then you find out who owes that debt. What I know is that they were sold that debt at a discount. So we go and we ask them, what do they want for it? Well, can you give us $200? Okay, then you're fine. We'll pay you $200 and you take that off the person's report. Now they get another 25 points.
No,
so before we finish, you got 75 points in that first 6 months, and now your life is on a trajectory. Now and now you got to put you to work to build your thick file, which creates
now,
you.
Now I'm both inspired and I'm outraged. I'm inspired because this is great, and I'm outraged. Shouldn't the government be doing this? Look, you're a great dude. But it seems to me that this is a function that the government should be engaged in, involved in, empowering people, helping people, help people access money. I read in your book that Abraham Lincoln actually inspired you to a certain extent. Can you tell us why the government is not doing this and how the government almost was in the business insurance?
So this all started not in 1960 or didn't start in the Great Depression. This all started in 1865. March 3rd, 1865, President Lincoln, after the Civil War, after he signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which is all that anybody seems to remember about his freedom movement or his freedom acts, he had done something before Emancipation Proclamation and something right after that was transformational. Not in the book. January 16th, 1865, in Augusta, Georgia, and this was the Georgia March to the Sea was what turned the Civil War around, and they burned down Atlanta in the, as part of this, where the general was camped out in Augusta, and Secretary of War Stanton went to Augusta and met with 20 ministers, and they asked the 20 ministers, black ministers, what do you want after slavery, after the Civil War, what do you want in return? They didn't say, I want a government program. They didn't say, I want a handout. They didn't say, I want even an apology. They said, I want land. And I want to do for myself. I want to plant my seeds. I want to take care of my family. Self-determination. The general promised them 400,000 acres from South Carolina, from North Carolina, all the way south, down the coast to the tip of Florida, 30 miles in. You might recall that is 40 acres and a mule. But that story was even perverted. It was 40 acres per plot. When they signed Field Action 15 and gave them the land, within a month, 4,000 people immediately took ownership of their land and started working. The general was so inspired, Van. He said, my God, they're so industrious. He told the army, give them a mule to work that land. That's where 40 acres and a mule came. It wasn't about a handout. It was about a hand up. That was January 16th. He then said, because the Congress has not codified Field Action 15 yet, I'm going to let the military protect all the landowners until such time as the military, as Congress can confirm this. Now you fast forward to March 3rd, 1865, and Abraham Lincoln signed the Freedmen's Bureau Act, and the first action of the Freedmen's Bureau Act, second action, was the Freedmen's Bank. The Freedmen's Bank's mission was to teach freed slaves about money. Now, that may not seem all that radical, but think about this. The President of the United States thought the most important thing he could do for freed slaves after physical emancipation was to teach them about the free enterprise system, about the language of money, call it financial literacy, and to give them access to capital, what? To finance the land. It was radical. It would be radical today.
Mm.
It was mind-blowing in 1865, and I think it got him killed. He was dead 5 weeks later. They assassinated him April 16th, 1865. He was going to finance all these former slaves and put them into the free enterprise system. He put the bank, if anybody is questioning intentionality, he put the bank across the street from the White House. So if you know Washington, D.C., you have the White House, you have the old executive office building to the left, that was the Department of War, to the right is the Department of the Treasury. So you had what was most important to him, closest to him, so he could go from one building to the next, making legislation and paying for it, making legislation and paying for it. Across the street is Bank of America. It was the Riggs Bank. That was the Freedmen's Bank.
Wow.
Right across the street. So he could see it, but he died before it was ever ever in the law. Now, when he died, the bank's mission was just investment and education. The vice president, Van, was a Southern segregationist because he loved field teams of rivals. He figured, I'm not going to get killed after the war. if I'm going to get killed, it'll be during the war. So I'm going to, after the war, I'm going to hire this former Southern segregationist to bridge me back to the South so we can have one country. Well, when he got killed, Andrew Johnson became president. And Andrew Johnson, and I quote, said, "As long as I'm president, this nation's going to be run by white men." He then told the Southern governors, "I can't reverse all this crazy stuff that Lincoln did, but I can ignore it. I'm canceling Field Action 15. I'm pulling my military out the South. Do as you like. If you want to know where the Klan came from, the Rough Riders, and where the intimidation strategy came from, and how you had two laws in a nation, you had federal law superseded by local laws, that's the answer. He just let the South drift." He then reversed everything he could, or diluted it in Washington, one of which was to let the Freedmen Bank drift, and in 1870 changed it to allow investment and other speculation. Frederick Douglass, the Colin Powell of that day, with a stellar reputation, went in to try to run the bank and save it. He put up $10,000, Van, of his own money in 1870. That was $1 million. The bank failed, and he went to Congress and asked them to close the bank, because he knew that it was only going to get worse. There were 70,000 black depositors. I just love this. I love this story, and I love what it says about us. I love what it says about America. There were 70,000 former black slaves who put their money, former slaves, into the government's bank based on a promise of a Constitution, a Bill of Rights, and a president who said, "I'm going to make this real for you." The bank failed, and all of them lost their money. And Frederick Douglass said the failure of this bank did more to set free slaves back than 10 more years of slavery. And you pop your fingers. And the next time we had a conversation about money was 100 years later with my mentor, Master Andrew Young, and his friend, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., in Memphis, Tennessee, with the Poor People's Campaign of 1968, where Dr. King was killed 2 weeks before his first march on Washington on April 4th, 1968, as he marched, it set out a framework for a movement. And he said, Dr. King said this: "You cannot legislate goodness, and you cannot pass a law to force someone to respect you. The only way to social justice in a capitalist country is economic and ownership." That was King in 1968. He was dead within a week. So to answer your question, this is not a book. It's a memo. It's not like we got the memo on free enterprise and capitalism and screwed it up. That's my premise. That's the whole premise of the book. If you're curious about why poor people are poor, and I don't mean, look, he's talking about black people. No, I'm not. You live in San Francisco, make $70,000 a year or less, you are struggling to make ends meet. You live in Atlanta, make $50,000 a year, you're struggling to make ends meet. You live in Washington, D.C., make $50,000 a year, you're struggling to make ends meet. New York City, $75,000, $80,000, struggling to make ends meet. I don't care whether you're white, black, red, brown, or yellow, you want to see some more green. Today, the issue is not about race, it's about class. And Ferguson, Missouri is not about race, that's about poverty. So we're fighting a new war with old tools. But we weren't given even the old tools when we were in the old war. Now we like in software upgrade 28, dealing with Stone Age strategies, and so if you have families with too much money at the end of their money, which is half of America making $50,000 a year or less, they are driving the largest economy on the planet with no memo. Let me ask you this question: somebody here works for a company. Mike, I'm gonna pick on you. You work in the C-suite, and this wonderful young lady works with you in the C-suite. I'm going to ask both of you. You. For 3 months, you never saw Michael or anybody in the executive board. You weren't given a memo. Your memos were cut off. Your email was cut off. I mean, all email. Your inner office communications was cut off. You weren't invited to any strategy meetings or board meetings. You got no memos for 3 months. The memo, the CNN comes to you and puts a mic in your face and says, "Can you please opine about the future strategy and direction of Bank of the West? Go. It's live TV." What do you say? You have anything to say? But, Now, you're bold. Hold on a minute. What? I think she should be a politician because that was a bold lie. What do you say? Blah, 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 blah. Look, anybody who is telling the truth says, I have nothing to say. Nothing. Because you don't have a clue what's going on. I'm not talking about 3 months, man. I'm talking about 150 years.
Part of the reason that people are so nervous about you is because we're having a very difficult time putting you in the box of the racial discussion in America. Let's just be honest. You don't sound like a liberal, progressive Democrat who has a program for every problem, which is what we're used to. You don't seem to be running for office. You don't sound like the conservatives that we hear on Fox, who are many of them now African-American, who seem to take great joy in rubbing our noses in the problem without having much of a solution beyond don't let your pants sag. So what are you? It's very troubling and difficult because you know more civil rights history than the civil rights folks. You seem to have a better sense on economics than the right wing. What are you doing?
I love this guy. I'm trying to save America. Dr. King's movement was not about black people. Dr. King said, I'm here to redeem the soul of America from the triple evils of war, racism, and poverty. He believed that setting black people free, who happened to be on the tip of the sword of 1958, made America better. He believed that it made America more competitive. It's no different than when I go to the Middle East and I don't give them a human rights lecture about women. I have an office in Saudi Arabia, as an example. I just simply say, look, if I have 100 people on the field of battle of competitiveness, and you've got 50 people on the field of battle competitiveness because you left 50 women at home because of some backwards philosophy that you say is tied to theology, which is not. It's not in the Quran. It's tribal and cultural and chauvinistic. I say, I'm going to win every time. In fact, I'm going to clean your clock. It's just simple math. I've got 100, you got 50. So you need to have everybody on the battlefield, if for no other reason than to be the world-class nation, competitive, that you say you want to be. It's getting to the same outcome, it's just a different argument. I believe that you can take no pleasure in the fact that there's a hole in my end of our boat. I believe that we are rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. The ship is sinking and we're picking drapes. I believe the Bible says there is no vision, the people perish. And in the absence of a vision, Van, people default to being an expert in what they are against because they have no clue what they're for. So you have a lot of so-called politicians who used to be called public servants, who are about me and not about we, who are not about trying to win for America, but trying to get reelected, and they're an echo chamber for the fear of their little district, telling people, fanning the fears of their worst insecurities and aspirations versus having a vision for the future. And I'm convinced people have no clue what a solution looks like, and I'm basically a capitalist with a heart. I believe in the marketplace. I believe my best philanthropy is giving people a job. My payroll is $400,000 every 2 weeks. I've been making payroll for 22 years. And when I give somebody payroll, they are then going and paying their mortgages, and they're paying their car notes, and they're putting their kids through college or school, and they're putting food on the table. And that is what's driving the greatest nation on the planet and giving people an opportunity to go have self-determination.
Well, let's talk about that all sounds
and
good.
And giving back, because most philanthropy comes from middle class.
But look, give him a round of applause for that. That sounds good. But I'm not going to let you off the hook. what you're saying, I think, is riveting. But let's take a real example. You mentioned Ferguson. Can you, this is great. You're here, you're in San Francisco, you're all around the world.
I was there 2 days ago.
Oh, well then.
With Bernice King.
So,
and you were there a month ago.
I was there a month ago. So tell me your analysis of Ferguson. I know you said it's not about race. Obviously, race plays a role. But what is it from the perspective of a black capitalist with a heart, cares about America, with global vision, you get off an airplane, you go into Ferguson, the heart of Ferguson. What is your message in that situation?
So I showed up. I hadn't planned on speaking. Dr. Bernice King decided she wanted me to say a few words at the end. And I told him when I got up, I said, look, you guys are not going to like what I have to say. And there was a bunch of young brothers in the back to the left. And I looked at them and I said, you're fighting the wrong war with the wrong tools with the right heart. Going after these police officers, and this one all, and by the way, let me be clear, the officer was wrong. Let me make that, this is a tragedy. And let me also say that that would have never happened in Beverly Hills. I don't care what race you are. If you were in downtown Beverly Hills, and let's assume that the person was belligerent, let's assume they were on drugs, let's assume that they were obnoxious, let's assume they were even aggressive toward the police, unarmed, but aggressive, they would have surrounded him with three patrol cars, they would have tasered him to tomorrow, or yesterday, he'd have had burn marks on him for three generations to see, but he would have made it to prison. You only get the whole clip loaded in your face when they don't perceive you as having any value whatsoever. So what I told the young man was, Ferguson is going to keep, Michael Brown is going to keep happening over and over and over again with your strategy. Now, you're going after this officer. I have two problems with that. Number one, the number one cause of death for black men 18 to 35 is not police officers in blue suits. It's brothers in white T-shirts. It's black-on-black crime. So you cannot be a legitimate protector and voice for your neighborhood if you're not being honest with yourself and the public about all of your problems. So you got to call out the officer at the same time you're calling out yourself. I believe in the bum factor.
What?
The bum factor. 20% of everybody are bums. I got bums in my family. You got bums in your family. 20%, everybody got a cousin, Louie, who you don't want your uncle hanging around your kids because you know something wrong with them. 20% of Republicans are bums. 20% of Democrats are bums. 20% of your employees are bums. I mean, everywhere you go, there is a, can I get an amen? There is a bum factor. So whenever you generalize, you discriminate. And I'm looking for a solution wherever I can get it. So most police officers are good people. Yeah, there's these guys over there. They're bums, all right? So let's deal with that. But I said the second problem I have with your analysis is you're not spending your energy on what you're for. You're spending your energy on what you're against. And you're taking this moment that the death of Michael Brown gave you, and you're not honoring it because if... Take all these resources that are now coming to your city that nobody ever heard about Ferguson before Michael Brown. My family grew up in East St. Louis, 10 minutes from Ferguson. I never heard of Ferguson before. And my family grew up around him. So you have now the world's attention, and what are you doing about it? Running up and down the street, tearing up your own neighborhood? Come on now. So let's take all that energy and let's aim it at a solution that actually creates jobs and economic opportunity and prosperity and entrepreneurship. And let's get you focused on what you're for versus being obsessed on what you are against. And when I told these brothers this, they did this. They were waiting for somebody to just say the truth. And I get that wherever I go, white, black, conservative, liberal, Republican. This is just radical common sense. That's all it is. It's just common. There's nothing in this book that's not common sense. And so when I left there, the police chief said he wanted to partner with me. The school chief said he wanted to partner with me. The young kids, the church wanted to partner with me. So I think that we need to honor civil rights and then pick up a mantle of civil rights.
So what you say, silver?
Silver rights.
Like silver and gold?
That means that if you deal with class, you get race for free.
You're listening to a broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. Become a member of the Commonwealth Club and support the club and its radio broadcast by visiting www.commonwealthclub.org.
You don't like people to talk about this stuff, and it's not important to you, but it's important to me, and it's important to a lot of folks in our community. We know not just where you are, and when we see you on TV, and we see you around the world, and we see Bill Clinton is endorsing your book. Al Gore endorsed mine, so I guess I'm second place.
That's all right, but you make more money than I do.
Says he. But you know, your book comes out. Bill Clinton's on the cover of it. Bestseller, already in 4 different languages. Only been out 4 months. It's the only African-American author talking about economics on the bestseller list for several years, as best I can tell. And it's just getting started. We see that, and we celebrate that, not just because that would be good for anybody, but because we know that for a kid from Compton, homeless for 6 months, went through the things that you went through, saw the stuff that you saw, there's a reason that you can say the stuff that you can say to bank presidents and brothers on the block. And you don't have to be saying it. You could just go and get your own check. And you are writing paychecks for other people. And you're creating a book and a pathway for other people to do what you did. And I'm proud to know you. And this crowd, some people knew you before, some people didn't know you before. But I want to give you a round of applause. You are a leader and a hero to all of us.
I will tell you, when I finished the comment in Ferguson, I left them with something. They said, well, what would you do? And I said, I would do 12 Hope Business in a Box Academies in Ferguson. They said, what's that? It's a course in financial literacy, language of money. It's a course in dignity, values. It's a course in entrepreneurship, can't get a job, create a job. It's 25 businesses you can start for $500 or less. It's a pitch event in your school auditorium. Think Shark Tank for kids. It's a 2-minute timer on stage because life is tough. It's 2 minutes. Go, pitch your idea. When they pitch and do a good job, endorphins kicking on the right side of their brain about hope and opportunity, and somebody's paying attention to me, we will approve their Hope Business Box Academy Award up to $500. We'll fund the business. The money goes into a bank account. It's the only way you're going to get it, which now deals with the unbanked issue. By the way, Ferguson's the most racially divided unbanked city in America. 4% of residents are white unbanked. 26% are black unbanked. And then we assign a role model to you and a business role model. And Gallup helps you understand your strengths through the strength finders, because tests, if you have low self-esteem, a test will underscore how dumb you are in math. If you were dumb in math, the test proves you were dumb in math. If you're dumb in English, the test underscores how you were dumb in English. It's reinforcing your negative versus inspiring your strength and your positive. We take a strength finder to tell you what you're good at, and then we push through with that by wrapping you around that strength, some support. And the back end, Gallup measures hope, well-being, engagement, financial literacy, and economic energy. We found a doubling, Van, in every school we've gone to of economic energy. A doubling of kids who want to be entrepreneurs. A doubling of kids who want to be small business. A doubling of kids who think they can change the world. And while we don't believe every kid can be an entrepreneur, an entrepreneurial mindset will benefit everybody, irrespective of whether you're running a household, a business, a school, a nonprofit, the Commonwealth Club, get it, around it, through it, up, over it, to it, never give up. A resilient attitude will always benefit you and leave you in a position to become a resilient leader. And they asked me to come back, so I'm coming back.
What do you think about the programs of LBJ's Great Society? They're often demonized on the right. Some people say we'd have a lot more poor people if we didn't have them. Some people say we'd have a lot fewer. What's your view?
I think that very much like, first of all, I think LBJ gets none of the credit he deserves. It wasn't John F. Kennedy, God rest his soul, that passed civil rights legislation. It was President Johnson. And you told me that I should share every now and then a speech story. So I'll give you one story. He passed this first civil rights bill. Dr. King, go ahead.
Just in case people don't know why this is so important. Part of his brilliance is that he is a great student of history, and he can link this movement back through Frederick Douglass to Abraham Lincoln. But the other part of it, he's got great mentorship from Andrew Young, who was the right hand of Dr. King. So when you hear this brother talking, he's talking as somebody who is as close to, in his age group, a direct disciple of Dr. King as you have walking around. And so some of the wisdom that I get from him when I talk to him comes to him through Andrew Young, Dr. King's right-hand man. So go ahead.
So there's a lot of stories most of the brilliance behind the movement is unarticulated. Some of it's in the book, like the role that free enterprise played in the civil rights movement. It was free enterprise that integrated the South. It wasn't government. You think about what did people integrate? It was JCPenney's, it was Woolworths, it was counters at the soda shops. There was business people that Andrew Young met with quietly behind closed doors after Dr. King shut down the economy in those little towns because the customers were black. When Rosa Parks wouldn't get off the bus, they said, let's not ride the bus. We're not trying to hurt you, but we're not trying to give you our money to sit in the back. The bus company was bankrupt in 9 months. And Dr. King realized the strategy, so he would protest, and he would never protest after 2 o'clock because he needed time for the media to get their film on a plane to New York in time for the 6 o'clock news. It was all part of a larger strategy. But after shutting down the economy, he'd send Andrew Young behind closed doors but to meet with the business leaders with this philosophy I said earlier of always leave your adversary with their dignity. And he would meet with them until they went from here to here to here because their cash registers were starving. And they said, how do we get our customers back? Simply, just take down the signs. And that's, so Andrew Young was an equal partner in this movement. It's just that Dr. King had the more visible role. So in this example, he's meeting with Johnson at 5 o'clock in the residence at the White House. You know how this works. That means he didn't want the media to know about it.
That's right.
He was trying to hide the meeting. He said, Dr. King said, I want a second civil rights bill. And he said, I'm sorry, Dr. King. You think the president's got more power than he really has. I can't do anymore. So they left, and Dr. King is smiling. So Andrew Young said, why are you smiling? We got a hand in our head. He said, well, Andy, the president said he thinks that we think he's got more power than he really has. Andy, let's go give the president some more power. He went and marched on the Pettus Bridge and created the energy in the environment that a month later, I think it was a month later, Johnson signed the second civil rights bill. There was a third civil rights bill. It was the Open Housing Act of 1968, and that was signed 1 week after King was assassinated, based on his work in Chicago around economics. King's economics was socialism. I mean, just to be blunt about it, he thought the government should provide everybody with a living wage. But he was a theologian. I mean, he was a man of the cloth. What do you expect him to say? I mean, so it was 1968, a theologian pushing this agenda. I think it was a very rational approach. Johnson was trying to get us off the bench and trying to get us on the field and dealing with some extremely basic needs. I think his Great Society days, his programs were not perfect. Some of them were going to fail. Some of them were going to succeed. It's irrelevant. It's no different than after the Great Depression. He was creating a tone and an environment for systemic cultural change that said we care about poor people. They have a role and a place in our society, and we should provide some reasonable safety net. Of course, the war distracted his efforts, and we will never know how right they were. I do believe over time that would have been what I call a software upgrade. The LinkedIn founder said, if you're not slightly embarrassed by your 1.0 software release, you release too late. So a good way to understand where Johnson and Dr. King was going is Ambassador Andrew Young's foreword in this book.
They say, traditionally, disadvantaged minorities have significantly higher rates of out-of-wedlock births, lower high school graduation rates, higher drug use rates, and pervasive youth gang violence. What impact do you think dysfunctional culture has on traditionally disadvantaged minorities?
Whoever said that is brilliant. I mean, Quincy Jones says it takes 20 years to change a culture. In the last 20 years, we've made dumb sexy. We've dumbed down and celebrated it. There's nothing wrong with our kids. When I was growing up, you were growing up, there's 35 kids in a classroom, 30 kids wanted to learn, 5 kids acted like a knucklehead. You go into the same school, the same kids, 30 kids acting like a knucklehead, 5 kids ashamed to admit they want to learn. Nothing wrong with those kids. They've been hijacked by thug culture. This crisis was not an economic crisis. It was a crisis of virtues and values. We're not we're human beings. We're not human beings, quoting Deepak Chopra, having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a human experience. We are enormously influenced by our environments. In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, this uniform was the basic uniform in the black community. You could be a barber. You could be a trash man. You wore a suit. I give you $1,000. You walk through one of these hoods now and you find somebody wearing a suit if you're not a detective. But there's nothing wrong with us other than we've been hijacked by thug culture. I have defined in this book poverty. It's not what you think it is. Here's poverty. Half of poverty is low self-esteem. If you don't believe in yourself at 9 in the morning, by 9 p.m. somebody's going to tell you who you are. If you don't know who you are, you'll get nothing done in this country. What people see when they look at you is confidence. When people see when they looked at Michael up here was confidence. When I look at this young lady, I see confidence. Half of success is confidence, is belief in yourself. I think that, I'm going to say this, I haven't said this on media before, I think that this is not in the book, I can't prove it, but I believe that 70% of all African Americans, because of their unique experience in this country, are clinically undiagnosed depressed. Now, if that's true, self-esteem is the manifestation of that, or low self-esteem. I think the second part of poverty is role models and environment. Why am I a businessman? My daddy was. I'm not a genius. I'm role modeling. Why are you a black man with a suit on who thinks you can do anything? Because you saw young black men grow. I don't even know your story, and I know your story. I was with a sister at CBS doing a TV show earlier today, and I don't even know her story, but she saw a black woman somewhere who was behind the scenes and said, I can do that. Why do kids want to be rap stars, athletes, and drug dealers in inner cities? The kids aren't dumb, and they aren't stupid. They're brilliant. They're modeling what they see. Everybody's aspirational. Everybody's aspirational. And environment. You hang around 9 broke people, you'll be the 10th. So if you have low self-esteem, you have horrible role models, you have a crappy environment, you have low aspirations, code word for hope. The most dangerous person in the world is a person with no hope. And then your opportunity seems capped because you don't see skyscrapers in your neighborhood and you don't know where you're going to get a job. Then you are poor. And by the way, you can be poor at $30,000 of income. You can be poor at $150,000 in income. And I mean, we don't have time to get into it, but I can explain to you, somebody sitting there going, how are you going to be poor at $150,000? If you were making $250,000 and you lost your job and the only other job you could get was $150,000 and 3 people in your block lost their job, so your role models now are not as up as they wanted to be. Your self-esteem is in the toilet. Your environment, now your daddy lost his house. Your environment is not as positive as it used to be. Your aspiration, your hope is down, and your opportunity seems capped. You're now living in fear. You're poor.
Now look, here's what you say has just enough truth in it that heads nod.
But
it also makes me uncomfortable. And the reason why, and I want us to get into this now. This everything you just said is true. I mean, my father was. I mean, since you raised it, my dad was born in segregation and poverty in Memphis, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. He was actually in Memphis when Dr. King was killed. Mm-hmm. But his father died when he was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. Last words from my grandfather to my father: "You are the man of the house. Mm. You have to take care of your brother, your sister, your mother." Mm. And he died. My father, when I was a child, we would go to Memphis. Everybody would see my father. They'd say, "Hey, old Willie, good to see you, old Willie." That made sense to me because he was old,
yeah.
From my point of view. They started calling him that when he was 7.
Seven. Yeah.
Because he walked around trying to be like his father. He put himself through college. He joined the military. He put himself through college. He put his brother through college. He put his cousin through college. He put me through college and my sister through college.
Wow.
So I believe, and he would say, very much like you, I don't want to hear it. You know, we come back from school, college, the school's racist or whatever. He goes, "Do they put any dogs on you? Do they put any fire hoses? Any Ku Klux Klan?" Well, I don't want to hear it. Do your thing. So that's a part of the truth. But there's also Wall Street. There's also predatory lending. There's also politicians who are taking money and defunding things and giving the starting dumb wars. There's a system out there as well. Are you letting Wall Street off the hook for crashing the economy? I mean, what do you think about
no.
the structural stuff?
Yeah. So Bill Clinton has a great quote.
Sorry.
It's hard to get people to agree to the truth when the liar is paying their paycheck. And that pretty much describes everything you just asked. Are there poverty pimps? Of course there are. The alternative financial services sector is almost a half a trillion dollars a year in revenue. If you're making $500 billion in revenue, you're going to protect that with every fiber of your body. If I get knocked off, let's assume we succeed in creating 1,000 Hope Inside locations and bank branches. I think we will. We have 100 in the last 250 days. If we succeed in delivering the memo, thank you, Barry Kohler, for being my publisher and helping me with this. We succeed in delivering the memo to a new generation. If we succeed in creating Hope Business Box Academies in 2,000 schools and transforming the attitudes of young people and giving them a sense of resiliency and leadership and aspiration and hope again, then, and you hear I was killed in 2022, you don't need to go to the Klan. They didn't do it. You don't need to go to Wall Street. They didn't do it. You didn't need to go to the normal suspects. It'll either be the alternative financial services industry or it'll be drug dealers. They're going to catch me in an alley and say, look, man, for my kid's sake, I love what you're doing, but you're messing with my business. You're messing with my customers. Everybody talking about hope and stuff. People want to go to school. people talking about taking care of their responsibilities and wanting to be sober. You got to go. But this is nothing new. That's why they knocked off Jesus. That's why they knocked off Gandhi. That's why they knocked off Dr. King. That's why they knocked off Malcolm X. This is nothing. This is not a new conversation. This is the same conversation. Don't think that predators just showed up in 2009 with a global economic crisis. But you got to, let me tell you what, you have to work real hard to prey on me. Nobody gave me a subprime loan because I'm not going to take it. And before we start putting this at the floor of poor people, because poor people don't have $21 trillion to lose. I was with Andrew Young, and I asked his gardener, hey, man, how you dealing with this global economic crisis? He said, I'm fine. I was poor before this crisis. I won't be poor after. It's all my rich white friends want to kill themselves. You got people with college degrees. In fact, the number one group of subprime recipients were middle-income white men, single head of households. You can take all income, all minorities together. This is a fact. Go to the American Bankers Association, Mortgage Bankers Association website, pull down the report. It wasn't the NAACP, it wasn't La Raza. It was a Mortgage Bankers Association report. Where are you getting these facts? And you take all minority groups combined. It does not come close to the number of subprime mortgages that went to middle-income white men. Middle-income white men defaulted more than anybody else. So these people with incomes, you people who had college degrees asking what's the payment, not what's the interest rate. We bought houses like you buy a toaster at Sears by asking what's the payment. This is just massive levels of financial illiteracy. Why middle-income white men? Because it was a single head of household. So when he lost his job, there was nobody else there to pick it up, and the whole thing just slid into oblivion. So it makes economic, it just makes good math sense. Now, are there predators? Yeah. I think we've got to not help them prey on us. This goes back to the inner city question. Check casher, payday loan lender, rent-to-own store, title lender. But if we're moving credit scores to 700, in 5 years, the check casher is forced to become a bank or credit union. The liquor store is forced through market forces to become a convenience store. The renter will decide on their own. If I'm paying rent for the same cost of a mortgage payment, why wouldn't I want to become a homeowner? I'm going to get tax breaks. I'm going to become a home. Now you got a tax base. You want to solve Ferguson? You want to solve Africa? Africa needs like a generation of taxpayers. That's it. Because when you got taxpayers, you got voters. Because when you own something, you are concerned about that and you're going to protect it. Capitalism came first in America. Then came politics. The politics were to protect the farmers with the individual property rights. We just never got this memo. I keep coming back to this.
Well, luckily, the memo's in book form. We have about, and you can get it, and I hope that you do get it. And I do appreciate Barrett Kohler for being your publisher. I know how difficult it is in this day and age. And when my book came out, The Green Collar Economy, nobody wanted to publish it because they said there was no African-American environmental writer that ever been a bestseller in the history of American literature and letters. They said, black people don't read green books, white people don't read black books, nobody's going to read your book. Yeah. That was literally the analysis of my book. Yeah. And
they were wrong.
And they were wrong. Bestseller. It's in six languages, 100 U.S. universities.
Somebody came up today, asked you to sign it.
Yeah. So, and you're in the same situation, being an African American, putting forward a powerful economic theory, and it's on the bestseller list today, and will probably stay there. And by the way, don't think he was being morbid when he mentioned the thing about being killed. There's one of many questions. After hearing the stories of Lincoln and MLK, I am wondering, are you worried about being assassinated?
No,
No, you're not. But I'm just saying, I didn't want
to. King said, you don't know what you're willing to die for, you aren't fit to live.
Exactly, yeah. So
although Andrew Young did say, when I first told him about the Freedmen's Bank, now I don't tell Ambassador Young many things. He tells me. I just sit there and, I mean, that's our domestic Nelson Mandela. I just sit there in absolute wonderment. And one of the few things I've ever told him that was a shock to him was the Freedmen's Bank story. He didn't know it, right? Mm-hmm. Almost nobody knows the story. And he looked at me and said, you know, people get killed for this kind of stuff. But, yeah. You know, he was on that balcony when Dr. King was assassinated. And the FBI told him after it was over, the investigators told him from the FBI, the message from the shooter was, if you miss Dr. King, get the strategist. Mm-hmm. So you imagine living with that for 50 years. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got survivor's guilt. He doesn't sleep. 82 years old, still trying to help people. But rainbows only follow storms. You cannot have a rainbow without a storm first. I believe in America. I believe that our best years are ahead of us, not behind us. I believe that poor people will rise up to help revitalize this nation, because it's happened before. Walmart, the biggest retailer in the world, is not Neiman Marcus or Nordstrom's. It's Walmart. That was created by a guy with named Sam Walton with a pickup truck. UPS was a guy with $100 and a bicycle. Coca-Cola was a couple of pharmacists, and you can go on and on. Every big business was once a small one. We celebrate Steve Jobs. He was fired from his own company for 12 years. Can you imagine how it is, fired from your own company? I mean, unless somebody's trying to try somebody come and fire me from Operation O. But we think that you know, every big business was once a small one. You know, J.P. Morgan Chase was a guy named J.P., another guy named Morgan, another guy named Chase. I mean, every big business was a small one, but jobs comes from small businesses, entrepreneurs, small startups and shoot-ups in year 3 through year 7.
We do not agree on everything, and we never have, but the level of respect and admiration that I have for you, for what you do, you go into some of the toughest communities, bring some people who most people can't get on the phone, you know, great bankers and financial leaders, will go with you, and I've been there. We'll go with you in some of the toughest schools in America with some of the poorest kids, and you get their attention within seconds. And you don't just transform the young people, you transform the adults that you bring with you, and you've been doing it every day for 20 years. You're an American hero. I hope people read this book, argue with it after you have read it. And I guarantee you, you'll take more good out of the book, and you'll do more with the book if you actually read it, as opposed to critiquing it on LinkedIn based on the title. John Hope Bryant. So our thanks to John Hope Bryant. He is the chairman and the CEO of Operation Hope. He's also the author of a new book, How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to a Middle Class. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, internet. I am Van Jones, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.
You've been listening to the weekly broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Club. Today's program was made possible through the members of the Commonwealth Club and Bank of the West. The Commonwealth Club is a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum dedicated to airing diverse viewpoints on important topics. If you'd like to become a member of the Commonwealth Club or purchase a CD of this program, visit www.commonwealthclub.org. Also, stay in touch with us online at Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Please join us again next week for another outstanding program from the Commonwealth Club of California.